Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, boys and ghouls of all ages, to the Ghoulcast, our Halloween special 2016. Tonight we'll be telling tales to turn your blood chilly and to tingle your spine. It's just in time for Halloween, so turn the lights down. Sit by the dim little fire of your iPod. Listen along as we tell tales of the night. First up is Glenn Birdsill.
This first thing I'm going to read is called Ghoul Living Over Nothing. A rationalization. Nietzsche is dead. The ghoul snuck in the tomb and ate his head. Under dark evening skies, it ate his molded head. Grumbled, then down its wiry throat the head tumbled. And a million times over the philosopher dies, and the ghoul rubs its stomach, and with relish it sighs. And now to escape and waltz at the ball, it exited the tomb and leapt the cemetery wall. Crawling through the shadows of the street, after all, a ghoul has to eat. He wandered to the dreamer's ball, and still in his death tuxedo dress, ghoul washed his hands of their mess, of Nietzsche's flesh, so at the entrance of the soiree, dipped his hands in the fountain there, and stared into the reflection of the beast that he bore within and hid in his sin. Slowly the creature crept across the inlaid stone toward the sounds of shuffling feet it could be seen through, open double doors, and the shifting sway of the beat enticed it all the more down to his core. His thoughts were very clear as the grin from ear to ear began to appear. Stepping inside, the ghoul handed the doorman his cape, fluttering down to lose its shape, and stepped in further past the entry, past the clock, past the sentry. The guests waltzed on glass as graceful as a dream. He took the wine from a tray and decided that for a while he'd stay. A little longer, sipping the translucent potion, watching the dancers all in motion. The bubbles tickled and taunted his tongue, pulling him further into the virtuoso song. And there he saw her, standing across the room. She was dressed in elegance, from feet to face, of beauty, of satin, and of lace. Desperate to impress, in awe of her grace, the ghoul was suddenly tipsy, not from the alcohol, from one glass of champagne, from the sudden shock of beauty tumbling from brain to guts. And then this creature began reeling, as if dizzy under some heavy mask he'd soon be peeling, a demon off the masquerade, choosing instinct over sane, spinning in some maddening dance, always threatening to show his countenance. But under the same mask, that simple smile he bore, all but shattered as the weight of wine and women and reality flew and left his face on a heap upon the floor. The dancing stopped, all eyes were placed upon his powerless torso. He arose so sore. Slowly the people returned to their festivities, like nothing even happened, and the waltz began to glide, and his hunger seemed more difficult to hide. My eyes turned red, a pulse throbbing in my head, and I smelled the guests of dead. I feared that I might be fed upon their meat. I turned around to a trickling sound coaxed out of the oak harpsichord. The violins rushed, raced, a stained glass window I faced. Freedom, I need it now. And I have I lost touch with my heart? Its stillness beats, but it and my consciousness are miles apart. So I suppose the fun night's gaiety must be brought to a close. Amidst all the guests of the Habal, one guest staggered as if he might fall, brushing by the others quickly. and passing each their shoulders touch, he looks back, but not really, wanting to see on and on and on, closer to the far west wall. To what? Some minor social activity? And a great glass rose window is all. Still closer, the odd one draws and draws closer. Every man and woman dances with him, grabbing his hands and spinning. With the growing violins, the growing hunger, and they don't even realize that tonight, hidden under those tightly closed eyes, blue of the skies, red of blood, yellow of a sunny day, green of underground decay, these were the whole of the rainbow window. And in front of it, he leapt through the kaleidoscope in the hope of leaving these guests' guts behind. They all watched the colored explosion, a firework of the mind. The castle sat upon a cliff, and one single body fell to the ocean below as the never-ending waves enter and leave, and the ghoul is left on the jagged rocks to bleed. His undead shame in the rainbow window lies about its frame.
Damn, that was awesome, man. Can we react? I'm sorry, I had to. That was amazing. Loved it.
Next up is Paul, because I don't know if he'll introduce himself.
Yes. Okay. This is called Born from Darkness, as are all things that emerge from a womb. I am awake. I am hearing every engulfing sound as if it were multiplied. And sleep seems like a barely recalled dream. The candle is flickering on the table in the corner, and the shadows cast on the wall seem to be forming in a persuasively purposeful manner. Even though that can't possibly be true. Can it? Is that a hand? It rises, gets more substantial, then fades back into an oscillant shadow to regroup and reform, again and again. But no, that's illogical, even on a night like this. An evening of mornings in which I can hear the winds moaning dark secrets into the autumn night tide, disconcertingly, cautiously, in the patter of leaves crossing the sidewalk and coming to rest on the wall near my window. It's the early morning of the day before All Saints Day, and as such, in ways, has always felt this way for me, for some unknown reason, but tonight it's heightened even against itself. When I wake, if I ever cross from this glorified lethargy into actual slumber, I am to attend a play party with my siblings and friends. And for the first time, 9 days removed from my 16th birthday, I will be included with the group divination. I will discover my true love, or so I am told. My sister Effie, married now 3 years, swears that she saw his face in the mirror only hours after cutting open a slice of raisin-filled barmbrack cake, the center of which was marred, Effie would say gifted, by a small ring which she placed on her own hand. The first words spoken during the cutting of the cake are prophecy, she said, and the first words spoken on that night, 2 All Saints days ago, were from a distant relative who communicated 3 words, Henrietta is next. Those words startled me, even as my sister smiled while conveying the message earlier this evening. Aside from the fact that I much prefer my Nick, Hattie, to my given name of Henrietta, it seems terrifying to me that such prophecy could be made and with such a cavalier approach. And what did it all mean? Effie says it means next to Mary, which is only a minor comfort, since I have no desire to be a spouse while yet a child. I had pressed Effie for further information. What happened when you ate the cake? How did you know who you were supposed to marry? Did you even want to get married? She placed her palm on my own and laughed, affably but disparagingly. Calm yourself, Hattie, she said, gathering her thoughts. Here is what happened. I simply took the cake home and placed it on the table. I placed the ring on my finger, and I dreamed. I dreamed. She closed her eyes while belaboring this point, letting a smile fill the corners of her mouth. What, Effie? What was the dream? I had demanded, impatient in my own fevered curiosity. She paid no mind, instead keeping her eyes closed tightly. I dreamed of this perfect gentleman. I knew him somehow, yet had never met him. And not a month later, there he was, standing near the sculptures in Fairmount Park, more beautiful, more elegant than even my reverie could conjure. I frowned. Are you honestly speaking of Bert with this description? Effie opened her eyes and studied me with a half smile. You'll see, Hattie. Let it be. You will have your own Bert. I grimaced twice as hard and let an audible grunt of antipathy. I don't want a Bert. I won't want a Bert, I muttered. Ever patient, Effie rose to her feet, gave me a minor look of amused disdain, and patted my head. Keep this pretty brow out of the books for a while, Hattie. There's a real world out there, beyond the treasured tales. Tomorrow will tell its story, unconstrained by your skepticism. And now, as I lay here in my room, with the dwindling candle casting unfettered specters gazing on my bed, those words rumbled like calculated thunder in my mind. Tomorrow will tell its story. I don't know when I fell asleep, or the precise moment in which my intrusive yet mitigating candle gave up the ghost, but the smell of suffocated pyre filled my nose with a sense of panic and the extreme darkness as I opened my eyes. I felt as though my name had been newly spoken, an echo as yet hanging in the room. I sat up. Effie? I whispered with a restraint born of fear. No answer came. I rose from the bed and looked around, letting my eyes adjust to what little slivers of light were creeping in from the candle in my father's room. I paused, desperately fighting an urge to look out the window, but ultimately losing the battle. Of course, nothing could be seen aside from the outline of the weeping willow in the distance, highlighted by the oddly orange-hued moon. Sheer terror gripped me when I first heard the voice, singular in the blackout. Worry not, young one. I felt the breath that caused the sound tingle on my neck, though the speech was inaccessible and abstracted. I froze. Every part of me froze. A scream remained only a distant desire as I struggled to form any utterance. The voice became louder, closer. I know what anxiety creeps in your soul, Henrietta. Your worries are justified. All Saints' Day shall not settle your life in such a random matter. Effie's groom was chosen. Her future was planted in that raisin-forsaken cake. I managed to swivel a bit to the left and attempted to see the face behind the voice, which sounded like a weathered, haunted old woman. She laughed softly, disturbingly. Yes, I am what you wish I wasn't, a sorceress, an enchanter. But I assure you, my desire is only for your good, and my power is limited to this moment on this very day. I stumbled into an insignificant sentence. What day? Who? I'm your great-great-great-grandmother, Henrietta. Perhaps even more removed. Who can keep track? And this day, this blessed day, is the eve of All Hallows. On the strike of midnight, the rift in this domain shall render my words a distant memory. Heed them now. A strange calm drifted over me. What should I do? Play the game, little one. Eat that cake, she spat disapprovingly. And when the time comes, when the ring that has been entombed in that loaf peers up from your spoon, you must lie. I could now focus on an outline of a face, a body, on my bed. Lie? Yes, my love, lie. Hide the ring as quickly as you can. Pretend you never beheld its aspect. Eat the entire piece and find nothing to show. I smiled at this advice, my eyes narrowed. My fate should not be decided by such superstition. My apparitional ancestor had weaved me a way out by demystifying the accepted claims. Even at such a tender girlhood, the irony was persistent. But for now, child, you must rest. You find your way to earthly peace on this most hallowed of days. She was gone now from my bed, but I could still hear her voice. I did as she said and crept to the mattress and covered myself with a big wool blanket. Shall I speak to you again? I shall visit you as often as this realm's shrouds will allow, sweet child. Look for me in the gloom of every obscure shadow each All Hallows' Eve. Listen for my voice, carried through the trees by the sprightly gust of October's sweetened mistral. Follow the radiant reflection of the tide turning moons of autumn. I will be there. I smiled and closed my eyes. The smell of a distant torch rekindled filled my senses. The meager light of the candle renewed and was steadied by the harmonious stillness of peace of mind. sleep quickly washed over me, and I dreamed the pleasantly prosaic dreams of the contented.
Very good.
And now, Sir Chris Ringler.
So I kind of did a trilogy-ish in a loose... Well, we'll see. All right, so this is called Smashers. I don't know why I have to do that. He didn't know if he had ever loved anyone more than he loved her now, as she danced to the leaves with the baseball bat held high. She was dressed in the same clothes she'd had on during school, white tennis shoes, long red skirt, and orange sweater. And with all of that, she had added a cheap rubber werewolf mask as her crown. He watched her as she twirled through the leaves and swung the bat wildly upwards and then brought it crashing down on a blur that exploded the heads of the jack-o'-lanterns, their faces erupting outwards and upwards in orange spray. And the only sound was of the bat hitting the pumpkins and the rustling of the leaves. Her hair seemed to wave in the wind as if she was underwater. He didn't know if he had ever seen anyone that was happier than she was in these moments, with everyone at the church for trunk or treat, and her essentially alone to do her best and worst with no one to see. No one but him. And he loved her and he hated her in these moments. Since he was a boy, he had felt drawn to Halloween. His grandfather had always made his costumes for him, as his mother worked two jobs and didn't have the time, so it was Grandpa that took him out on Halloween and told him ghost stories and taught him about the history of the holiday. It was also Grandpa that taught him how to make jack-o'-lanterns, the real ones. Jack-o'-lanterns are meant to be smashed. They are. But jack-o'-lanterns, well, those are something different indeed. Something with a bit of magic to them. And you never, ever, ever smash those. Let me tell you why. The boy smiled, thinking about this, about Grandpa and Halloween's gone by. Grandpa was in a home now, and Mom was remarried to a man that didn't believe in Halloween, but the boy would still walk down to see Gramps as often as he was able, and in the fall he would tell him all about the autumn paradise of colors and smells, and of all the ghosts he had seen on his way to the home. Even if Grandpa didn't seem to know he was there, the boy knew that some part of him, the Halloween part of him, would. The boy smiled, but the smile faltered as he looked up and watched the girl take the bat to a Halloween decoration, and then another, and finally the girl stopped and stood over a stray tabby cat that hissed at her as she raised her bat. He broke cover. No, stop! He had been hiding in the bushes with his jack-o'-lanterns, watching her, loving and hating her, and trying not to be seen, but he had had no choice. He had to stop her. Please don't! He shouted as he ran towards her. The girl turned slowly, head cocked, and as the kitten hissed one last time and ran off behind some houses while her attention was gone for a moment. The girl lowered the bat and then dropped it onto her shoulder as she looked the boy up and down. You're that creep that watches me at school. The tard. Gross. What the heck do you want? Hey! Damn, the cat got away. Stupid cat. Please don't hurt the kitty. What do you care? Was it yours? No? Then shut up and buzz off. She turned to go after the cat, but he stopped her. But I have something for you. The werewolf girl turned again, and this time she turned slowly, deliberately, letting the bat fall from her shoulder onto the sidewalk. She was older than him, and much taller than him, and she bent down as she leaned forward towards him. Well then, let's see what you've got, Sparky. She was smiling beneath the mask, the sweat running down her face and pooling at her neckline. It was hot for Halloween, and making it feel as if it was May and not late October. She didn't care. She didn't care about anything but this moment. She gripped the bat tighter, lifted it off the cement a little, and smiled even more broadly. Here! The boy brought his hands up from behind his back and held them out towards her. One carved pumpkin faced her, but the other faced away. He smiled at her as he held the pumpkins out. He was wearing a white sheet with the face cut out so he could see. He made a poor ghost, and the fact that the sheet was yellowed and stained didn't help. Oh, well, gosh, what are these? Higher the bat went. They're jack-o'-lanterns. I made them. They're precious, kiddo. They're downright precious. Let me take a closer look. She bent closer and in one motion had the bat up and swinging. The bat connected and she leaned back as the pumpkins in the boy's hands exploded into his face. She noticed that the one that faced her resembled the boy. As the bat connected,
she realized it really resembled him, so much so that it almost looked like it flinched as the bat connected. The force of her swing drove it through the first pumpkin, but as she was so startled by what she saw that her swing rose and only managed to take the top of the second pumpkin off. The boy, seeing what she'd done, started to scream, but the scream was cut short as his head first caved in and then exploded in red chunks. He stood there a moment, a headless ghost, then fell to his knees and fell backward onto the sidewalk in a growing red pool. The other pumpkin dropped from his hands onto the sidewalk and rolled a little so that it faced the werewolf girl. She gasped as she realized she was looking into an exact replica of her own face. She felt the sweat coming warmer and more rapidly down her face and lifted her mask and ran a hand over her forehead and realized that there was a large piece of the top of her head missing. More warmth ran down her face and she looked at her hand and smiled as she dropped the bat and fell to her knees. She coughed and a blood bubble emerged and popped, splattering her face. He'd called them Jacks of the Lanterns, and he had one for her, one that looked just like her. The sight in the left eye went out, and she felt her face droop and her mouth dropped open, and as she looked at the pumpkin that could have been her twin and watched it do the same thing, blood began to pour out of the pumpkin's mouth, and then her own, and then Halloween was over.
Excellent. Cool. I love that one. That's actually in the new issue of Halloween Machine, October. So good.
All right. So the next one I have is called the Monochromatic Rainbow. Soon be in the book. So here we go, Monochromatic Rainbow. The royal we, of course, take great lengths to show the strengths in our lot and our ties. And with knots in my stomach and knots, my vision is blurred with the cries and pleas of, oh, please not that, oh, please not this, and a trickle of piss puts more knots not where I want them. Struggle. Struggle against the binds that bind us together. To surrender under the cover of an evening shade, hiding our features from the creatures that bury themselves under my hair. She's all around me. She's all around me. She lives in my blood and in my dreams. I've had yesterday from my fingertips to the creases in my lips. I can't hold on to the darling words that I hear in my ear, echoing the waves I feel deep in my guts. Do you remember? Do you? The times I rat-a-tat-tat on your window, love notes in Morse code, watching as you sit and watch a world turning cold. Did you know? I breathed onto the window and traced the heart in my chest, promising poisonless, noiseless rest, finding comfort in the forced, fevered dream, making it all seem like something touched by God. Retrained on the table saw, I see you tilt your head, straining against the bonds restraining you. You were the hunted. I was the haunted. I was enchanted. You are distorted. Beneath the single 40-watt bulb swinging in the corner of the room. I can see your words escape your bound winter mouth, like vapor helpmies floating up to heaven, the mumbles and sobs tasting like venom. The saw blade spins with one push of a button, and now the upper hand changes not to me, not to you, but to a fate that will end in the worst way for the two of us. The blade teeth thin down, biting February minutes into seconds. As you move along the blade, I hope to open you up and let the love pour out. My ears go blank except for a nursery rhyme, rhythm bouncing from inside my chest. Ripe skin breaks as the table shakes, and a red, red, red arch of blood flies through the air, and everything becomes silent and slow in a monochromatic rainbow.
Okay.
I don't want to read. I want to go back and read that one again. Okay. This is a short story. It's called A House That Is No More a House. I didn't know why it mattered. I don't remember when I realized that it mattered. I knew that it mattered once, long ago, and I didn't question why. I just accepted that it did because that's the way the adults acted about it. This is just a thing we do. We pick a costume. You can be anything or anyone you want for one day, for one night. You grab a pillowcase. When you're really little, maybe more care goes into that aspect. You get a little orange bucket or a store-bought bag with Mickey Mouse on it or something. You head out into the late afternoon, and you go door-to-door saying the magic words, trick or treat. Purplish hues soar across the sky. Bright fades into night, and the adults start driving us house to house. Darkness adds an unfamiliar air to it all, and inevitably, a sort of magic descends. Because at age 7, who is allowed to run around the neighborhood at 8 p.m. dressed as Superman, peeking in randomly on strangers and requesting food? It mattered. Once a year. And then Santa came, and Rudolph, and the candy that had dwindled into stray wrappers, chewed and frayed sucker sticks, and a squirrel nut zipper or two, lay untouched in the yellowed pillowcase under the bed, waiting for its All Hallows resurrection next autumn. It mattered. I didn't understand why. Didn't understand why we dressed up, why we shouted trick-or-treat, why we carved pumpkins into grotesque faces of fear and surprise. When you're a child, you accept more easily that a thing was here before you were, and assume that it's something essential, that it's supposed to be. It mattered in my teenage years, even when I waited indoors on the darkest holiday, counting the trick-or-treaters with my grandparents and watching marathons of seasonal scares on TV. I even remember a day, an afternoon just before evening, where I wondered if the curtain between worlds truly was brushed aside for hours of secret intermingling by the dearly departed. It mattered. It truly mattered. Until it didn't matter. Until childhood years went by, where I didn't get the freedom to be someone else, someone maybe better than me. I didn't wander to the neighbor's house under the ever-watchful eye of the moon, chasing Samhain into the haunted autumn eventide of the early hours of All Saints' Day. Until Halloween was just a busy, albeit lively night at the video store, with patrons asking for dart recommendations and scurrying off to laugh together at the anticipation of the scare. Until midnight on November 1st was just closing time. I trudged alone into our apartment with a small plastic bag containing pieces of Blockbuster peppermint candy, and watched Mary Tyler Moore while the rest of the world shook off the last vestiges of the Stygian night. But the next Halloween, if indeed it had ceased to matter, it began to matter again. I left the video store early, 4 p.m. I walked out into one of the most autumnly inspired October days of recent memory, and knowing it was Halloween, wondered if maybe fall had doubled down. I walked into our bedroom, where you were not. I had beaten you home from work. The room was quiet as I pulled the drape aside in our second-story window and peered out with a smile, watching the small children and teenagers and occasional adult laugh and run atop of the yellow leaf-covered ground. I remember this moment because I was again intoxicated by the afternoon of All Hallows Eve, so much so that I was startled when the phone rang. You were on the line, and we talked about our Halloween night plan, the first such plan I had made in many years. Sit out on the porch together, give candy to the costume ghouls and goblins until 8 p.m., when we would watch Pumpkinhead and cuddle under the blankets, sipping cider and munching candy corn. Hours passed, but you did not show. I counted the trick-or-treaters alone. I gave them candy, and managed to earnestly enjoy the first half hour or so of the mid-afternoon. But you still were not there, and I became worried. Back in our room, I tried to call, but you didn't answer. The first moments of Pumpkinhead started, and I decided to watch, waiting for you to come in and sit next to me. I watched alone. A few minutes later, you called. I answered with a combination of nervousness and relief, which turned into relief and a small twinge of anger when I heard your voice. Where are you? You missed trick-or-treating, and Pumpkinhead has already started. You expressed regret with your words, but your voice was elsewhere. I'm sorry. I will be there soon. I got sidetracked and had to stay over at work. We can watch the end of the movie together. I heard a man laugh in the background. I heard the muffle of your hand on the receiver. I heard you shush him. I gotta go, you said. I trailed off, but the sound of the click on the other end of the line broke through like the slamming of the screen door downstairs. After a moment of shock and wonder, I gathered myself together and looked in the mirror. I untucked my ugly blue and yellow Blockbuster shirt and glanced over at the TV. Pumpkinhead was chasing a hapless man through the fog of twilight. Come back to bed. This is getting scary. The sound of your voice startled me, and I turned to look at the bed. You were there, arms outstretched, reaching for me. I was stunned. How? Are you playing a trick on me? What? Why are you here? You smiled. No trick, just treat. How was work? I was still reeling. Head was spinning. It was work, I said flatly, but with a suspicious tone. Rented out 200 horror movies. He made a weird face. You guys are renting out movies now? Why? I pointed to my shirt at the Blockbuster logo, but the shirt was black now, and the logo was not present. I stumbled back a couple of feet and put my hands on my temple. What was happening? I gazed up into the mirror. You looked concerned behind me. I scanned around the bedroom quickly, looking for an answer. It was all unfamiliar, aside from my own shoes by the bed. I ran out of the room, down the stairs, and kicked the screen door open. Several children stood on the porch, and they backed up a little at the velocity of the open door, but remained fixated on their goal. Trick or treat? Yeah, sure. I fumbled for the candy bowl and handed them most of it without looking. Great costumes, I nodded, peering past them and into the street. A street that I had never been on. They piled off the porch quickly and moved to the next house. I stood dumbfounded on the stairs. After several seconds, the moon caught my eye. The Halloween moon. Baby, what are you doing? Your voice cut through in the doorway. I turned to look. It's not... Where are we? You turned your head sideways and gave me a slight vigilant smile. Home. But she called. And she was with someone, and I was alone. I was alone in my room, a different room, in a different house. You just smiled. Well, I'm here now, and it's Halloween. Magical cleansing Halloween. All Hallowtide. The holy evening. And we are together. I probably should have been scared. I wasn't. I was still feeling off balance. I was feeling like a stranger in a world where strangers were welcome. But when I reached you, you took your hand, and we turned to go back inside. You didn't feel like a stranger. And it mattered again, and I knew why.
Nice.
Thank you.
Alright, so this is called The Last Halloween. This wasn't Halloween weather. The air was warm. The trees still had most of their leaves. People still drove with their windows down and music up, and she had seen two groups of trick-or-treaters hitting the streets in shorts. This wasn't fall weather. This was summer weather, and it was bullshit. This is bullshit, she said to a ghost boy with the face cut out of his costume as he slowly walked by her with a glazed look in his eyes. She took another drag off her cigarette and dropped it beneath her heel. Dawn held her arms out and looked at her fake red nails and grimaced. She looked at the ridiculous mesh gloves she wore and stopped herself there and closed her eyes and shook her head. She knew the low-cut top she wore, knew the high-cut skirt she wore, knew the fishnets and suicide heels all too well. They were her sister's, so she had seen it all before, just never on herself. This was her sister's idea of a joke, or rather a punishment for a lost bet. Dawn and Jamie had bet on whether their advanced English teacher, Ms. Woover, was pregnant or just packing on her fall coat. Dawn had said preggo. Jamie had said it was... Wait, Jamie had been right, the bitch, and thus was born the Halloween costume from hell. Dawn sighed. Someone in a passing car catcalled her, and she responded with a middle finger and a gob of snot she hacked up and spat in the general direction of the car. It wasn't that she was opposed to showing a little skin, or was above looking for attention, but this was just tacky, and not in a good way. And Jamie knew that. Jamie, shorter, thinner, and less endowed, didn't have the same skin showing that Dawn did, and so for whatever the night held, it was bound to be filled with lots of idiot boys and freako men hollering at her and trying to get her number. Another sigh. Nobody likes a slutty dyke on Halloween, she thought, and let a laugh escape. Oh well. She was stuck like this for at least 4 hours, or she broke the bargain they'd made, and she'd be damned if she was going to renege on a lost bet. Dawn looked down the street and watched groups of laughing kids shuffling back and forth across the street as they zigzagged their way from house to house in pursuit of candy. Much of the town was off doing the trunk-or-treat thing, and the very thought of that, of bypassing Halloween's traditions for the flim-flam fakery of a euphemistic harvest celebration, frustrated Dawn to death. Halloween was one of the only holidays that let people, especially kids, be a little weird and a little crazy. Had it not been for Halloween, she may never have had the balls to kiss Sarah Ray 2 years earlier, and she wouldn't have realized, at least not yet anyway, who she was. Fucking adults. There's something special in the world leaves it to a fucking adult to ruin it somehow. Halloween. Her last Halloween, because past 18, it just got real weird trick-or-treating, and she had to waste a dress as this mess. What was it her sister had told her the costume was? Urban club trash, circa 2008. Whatever. It was stupid. And so was she. Happy Halloween. The sun was setting, but it was still warm enough to send sweat down the back of her neck from where her hair had ended. The shaved part began and down her back to her bra strap. It was a gross, slimy feeling and reminded her of when Rick 10 had French kissed her in 8th grade at his Halloween party. He was a vampire and she was, what was she? Oh, right. She was an undead mermaid. Maybe that was when she started to realize she was different, as her mother called her, because the thought of some boy's gross-ass tongue in her mouth or anywhere else repulsed her and still did. Dawn stood up from the bench and stretched, which just encouraged more catcalls and two middle fingers this time. She looked at the town clock and saw it was 8:40, which meant 3.5 hours left for her in the outfit. It also meant Melanie and Paul would be calling her phone over and over and over again, trying to convince her to go out to a party instead of trick-or-treating. She knew what the party would be, drunk people disguising themselves so they could do and say things they wanted to say and do but were too chicken to do it as themselves. It was awkward fumbling and sloppy kisses. It was hasty sex and regretful promises. It was trying too hard and feeling too much. She knew what Halloween parties were because for the last 3 years, that had been the capper for a night of trick-or-treating. And while those parties had opened a world, and Sarah Ray, to her, they had also shown her a sad side of her favorite holiday that she'd like to push off for at least one more year before she had to stare it in the face. You had two options for Halloween. If you were a kid, you trick-or-treated. If you were an adult, you partied. There was really no third option, which was a huge drag for Dawn. She was desperate for a plan C. She sighed and stretched one last time before leaning down to pick up her bag. Another cat call, and this time she decided she'd be a little vocal, but just as she was standing and turning to shout down her catcaller, she realized it was one Miss Sarah Ray passing on her bike as she headed home from work. Dawn smiled. Looking good, honey, though. Isn't that a bit much? Like ketchup on a hot dog? Don't ruin a good thing, baby. Sarah rode past Dawn, laughing. Hey! It worked on you! Dawn shouted after her. Just once, sugar. Just once, replied Sarah. The last part trailed off into the clear evening. Dawn looked up at the clock again, and it was just after 9. She had a little less than an hour. She hefted the pillowcase that served as her makeshift bag and took a few deep breaths. Just as she was about to head off, she realized what she was wearing and kicked the heels off. There was no way she could top her highest house count in an hour wearing heels. Her sister would have to eat it on that one. Jamie was at the same party as Mel and Paul, though, so there was no way she'd even know or care. She'd be too busy making eyes at Paul as Paul made eyes at Mel. She cringed to think of the stories she was going to hear in the morning and afternoon to come. That was for the future, though. That was for then. This was for now, and now was all about candy. Off in the night, someone screamed. Then another someone. The screams grew and turned to laughter, then became the howl of the holiday. Dawn smiled and started jogging down the sidewalk, ignoring the pebbles that bit into her feet as she got her engine revved. The first house was a block away, then it was full speed ahead. There'd be lights out, there'd be grumpy adults saying she was too old, and there'd be pennies and old folks' candy. But with all of it, there'd be one last Halloween, and by God, she was going to enjoy every moment of it.
Awesome. All right, so the next one I'm going to read is actually a partial, and hopefully it'll be something bigger and longer at some point.
All right.
All right, this is called The Graceful Goons. I'm throwing up elder gang signs and great old one tags, so the quality of a man is not judged by his rags. It doesn't matter what a guy wore when he's covered in so much gore. My gang is that of the deep ones, the Mego and Shub-Niggurath, counting on our fingers the unequal math. turning a bit loco because it is hard to twist with this brand new torso. Survival is more than our forms. It is beyond the gods or the monsters. Black seas can't move terror further from the new dark ages. As sorcery rages on our tongues, we live in Rhode Island.
That's awesome. Great. Want to read them both? Or? Okay. Well, I have two pretty short ones here. These ones aren't going to be bigger and longer.
You might be if you work on it.
If I work on it, yeah. All right, this one's called Phantoms. Ghosts are speedwalking through night and day, under the golden and beneath the gray, fiendishly bidding our vanities come play, never suspecting their status. Shadows of a time are holding a knife, walking grotesquely and larger than life. More wonderful our joy, less stronger our strife. Look, now they're coming right at us. Cold teachers are reading aloud from their books, reading us lessons and flashing us looks, cursing their seating charts for the vanity it took, wondering why we won't sit where they sat us.
Nice.
And then this one, oops, sorry, because I didn't get to print these out. Really? This one is some lyrics for a Lords of October song. And it's a love letter to Halloween, like much of Lords of October's output. It's called October 31. Past the horizon, the autumn setting sun, haunted by the specter of October 31, hand in hand through the holy night, guided only by harvest moonlight. Stray along the stolen path, place a kiss upon your lath. Fearing not, the veil is crossed. Voices whisper, hollow moths. Walking with us until the dawn, they dissipate, but I know they carry on, where it's always October 31. The time is always now when the moon hangs bright. We shall see what can't be seen on any other night. Carried briskly upon the autumn air, cross your fingers, witching hour, and you're there. Not to merely steal the winter through October's never-tarnished shores. I always wanted more. And the moment never seems to go. Light in the darkness, creatures roam and deep into the soul. Walking with us until the dawn. They dissipate, but I know they carry on. Where it's always October 31.
Neat. Nice.
For my last selection. No, this is called the Halloween House. Here we go. Jamie tipped the bottle back and felt the last of the warm beer slide down her throat and grimaced. Warm beer. Gross. Warm beer was better than an ill-fitting costume, which her sister Dawn would be wearing right about. She looked at her watch and saw it was 10:30. Now. She laughed on the couple making out on the couch in front of her, stopped what they were doing, and blearily looked back at her. She tipped the empty beer bottle to them and smiled. It was far too early to be as drunk as those two were, and she was far too sober to want to see how their newfound love affair was going to progress. Time for another beer. Jamie stood and smoothed out her costume. Grim Reaper. Not original, but it did cover things up, and for her, Halloween was a time for covering up. It was fun to show the goods every other night, but this night, this one night of a year, showing any skin was like putting your hand down into a toilet full of piranhas. She passed on that, which made her think of Dawn again and made her laugh again. This time, it was a male couple who looked up. They weren't drunk, but they definitely had that distant gaze that said there was something in their systems. Jamie gave them a wave and dropped her head and went into the kitchen. Had she wound up at a teen makeout party on accident? No? Yes? She couldn't even say she knew whose party this was, or who these people were. She'd heard about it from Paul and Mel, so she assumed that they'd be here eventually, and that they knew the home's owner. Paul, Jamie smiled. She wouldn't mind a couch session with him. She blushed. She had to admit that she'd fallen into a sort of handsome gentleman's bed the past Halloween. But that was different. He was in college, a really good college. She smiled. Well, okay, she had lost a bet, but it was the best bet she'd ever lost, by far. She entered the kitchen grinning, but then the grin fell away when she lifted her head. Rick Ten. Tenth grade crush and supreme douche was feeling up a very limp Sarah Ray. Sarah the gay Ray. Rick and Sarah were alone in the kitchen, and he had her in a corner where a countertop made an L shape leading from the sink toward the stove. She had her eyes closed while his were open, and he had one hand on her left boob while the other was up her skirt and on her ass. There was something frantic about what he was doing, something predatory. Jamie's first instinct was to dip out unnoticed, but this didn't have the feel of a Halloween hookup. Sarah was not bi. She was not curious. She was gay. And going through what she had to be as open about that fact as she was, she wasn't apt to fall into bed with a guy just on a lark. This wasn't that. This was something else. Jamie saw Rick's hand move higher up the skirt, a play on the schoolgirl cliche, and then start pulling downward. Whoa, 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 kids! Sorry to break up the fun, but Sarah, I need a hand. If you don't mind, let's take a sec. At the sound of her name, Sarah's eyes fluttered but didn't open. Can't you see we're a little busy here? Buzz off. Rick didn't look Jamie in the eyes and didn't remove his hands. Yeah, I can't buzz, though. Ricky, this is girl business, and I need to take my girl Sarah. Sarah, honey, come with me for a sec. Sarah mumbled and tried to move but started to fall. She's busy. Get the fuck out of here. Go suck another dick or something, you dumb slut. Rick looked at Jamie this time, and the look in his eyes sold it. She was done trying to be discreet. Okay, cool. Well, Ricky, it looks to me like you roofied Sarah and are trying to, how shall I put this? Oh, yeah, to rape her in someone else's kitchen. Now, this is the only chance I'm going to give you to let her go and get the fuck out of here before something really bad happens. Jamie reached into her purse and thumbed the guard off the pepper spray her dad had given her for Christmas. Rick let Sarah go and she slumped on the floor. Oh, really? What the fuck are you going to do? He took two steps towards Jamie, but she met him before he could take a third, sending a steel-toed boot upwards into his crotch. It was lucky she had on a big cloak, or she would have really regretted her kick, but with the extra leg room, she hit her target and dropped him to his knees. She let go of the pepper spray and pulled something slim and silver from the belt of her costume. She thumbed open the straight razor and held it to his face. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to cut you deep so that it scars, so that you'll never forget that I know what you are and what you were planning to do tonight. Every time you look in the mirror, you'll think of me, and maybe you'll think twice about doing this again. And if for one moment you think that you'll get me, that you'll find me and get me, let me assure you that my daddy, the policeman, raised me and my sister really well, and that you'll regret ever fucking with me, my sister, or any woman. Jamie gritted her teeth and made a long, thin cut from jaw to ear, and Rick screamed and fell away from her. His hands rose to his face and came back covered in blood. You fucking bitch! He started to rise, but a voice from behind him stopped Rick. Fuck pig, rape me? Sarah was trying to pull herself up from the linoleum, but was falling. Jamie looked back to Rick, and he had gone completely white, the blood pouring down from his cut unabated and looking fake. Rick quickly rose to his feet, gave Jamie a shove, and quickly got out of the kitchen, pushing past two more people and disappearing down a long hallway. Hey, asshole! You okay, Jamie? Melanie grabbed Jamie's arm, and Paul looked down the hallway after Rick, but it was clear that his attention was better focused here. Paul leaned in towards Jamie, his right hand resting on Mel's shoulder, then sliding down to her lower back. It was quick, but was also familiar and comfortable. Jamie felt something in her chest, but had to stay here in this moment with Sarah. What the hell's going on here? Paul asked from beneath a zombie mask. Paul, will you go check on Sarah? Get her up if you can. I think someone slipped or something. Mel locked eyes with Jamie. The motherfucker tended that? Should I ask what else he did, or are we just going to call the cops? Not right now. First, we need to figure out what he gave her, Jamie responded. Paul got Sarah up and had her lean on him. Her panties were down just above her knees. They were red and yellow lettering that said, Lucky You. Paul saw the panties and his face went white and he looked to Mel and Jamie. Jamie closed the blade on the razor and hurried over to Paul and Sarah, who was mumbling now. Jamie bent down and carefully grabbed the waistband of the panties and started pulling them up. Paul looked away. Sarah, baby? Sarah, honey? Can you hear me? Hey, Jamie. Hey, I know you. Hey, I saw your sister tonight. She looked good. Good to, never mind. Where am I? She leaned forward and vomited all over Jamie the Reaper. Mel, Paul, and Jamie looked at one another. They wanted to laugh. It was a natural laugh. They needed a laugh, but it didn't come. Sarah whimpered and slumped, but Paul picked her up. Jamie pulled the razor from its sheath and pocketed it. Put the razor and she pocketed it and then pulled the Reaper costume off and dropped it onto the floor to cover the puke and got beneath Sarah's left arm, and she nodded towards the kitchen doorway. Mel turned and headed out, but stopped. Wasn't there like a really long hallway there a minute ago? No, last. Pulse head cocked. Yeah, dumb shit was running down it toward a red door. I don't see a hallway or a red door. I see a living room. What the hell's going on? Look, whatever. Just head out. Head towards out. That's all I care about. I want her out of this house and into my car, and we'll take her to a hospital. And from there, we'll figure out what to do. Deal? Mel and Paul nodded their agreement. The foursome made their slow way through the paired couples, past the teens filming the couples, past a kid in a ghost costume with the face cut out. Whoever's party this was, they sure as hell had taste in friends and parties. Had weird taste in friends and parties. Jamie looked around the dim living room and realized for the first time there was no television. On the walls were hung dozens of photos of people in Halloween costumes. The photos were black and white, were color, some even looked almost bronze. The walls were absolutely covered in the photos. The four pushed past more people, and suddenly Jamie felt ice run down her spine. She recognized some of the people in the room from the photos. They were dancing, talking, playing games. The living room seemed somehow bigger, and there were more people. She looked, and the door seemed far away, down a long hallway with a red door. Jamie stopped moving, and Paul took another step, then was stopped because Sarah was standing up and was suddenly sober. Guys, why is Carol 10 standing over there? Didn't she die last Halloween? Jamie, Paul, and Mel looked towards the corner, and there stood Carol 10, smiling at them as she pulled a werewolf mask over her head. She had died the year before. The thought was that someone had jumped the curb and killed her and another kid, but no one knew for sure. That was her, though. That was her. Paul spun around and round, then lifted the zombie mask up. Can we get the fuck out of here, please? Sarah nodded towards another door that was to her left but had been hidden behind a group of people. Mel pushed ahead and started pushing people out of the way. At first they moved, but the closer they got to the door, the harder the people were to move, and they started to hiss at the four friends. When one older man in a top hat and monocle refused to move, Paul released Sarah, who was standing on her own now, and got in the man's face to tell him to move. Paul opened his mouth and then shut it as he realized this was his old next-door neighbor, Mr. Ambrose, who had died in 2010. The room seemed to spin, and Mr. Ambrose was laughing, laughing, laughing. Paul's arm shot out, and he shoved the dead man out of the way and reached back and grabbed Mel's hand. And she grabbed Sarah's, and Sarah grabbed Jamie, and the four of them pushed their way forward until they were at the door. Paul pulled the door open, and they ran out of the house and into the cool night air. Jamie turned and saw Rick 10 at the door, the blood gone, the scar formed, and no longer fresh. He was dressed as a vampire. He stood at the door a moment as the sound of the party behind him got louder and louder. He smiled at Jamie, and she saw a tear roll down his cheek. The door to the house slammed shut and left the four friends standing together on November 1st. Who's fucking... Jamie began. No idea. We heard about the party at school, Mel responded. The four turned from one to the other and looked back at the house, which had bright orange lights outlining the entirety of it, and a dozen jack-o'-lanterns were lit in what... watched from their spots on the lawn. Inside the home, the noise got louder and louder and louder and then stopped. The lights in the house and on the house all went out, and from inside came one last distant laugh, and then all was silent. That was enough. Jamie took Sarah's hand and led her towards her car. They could grab Sarah's bike the next day. She needed to see a doctor. Maybe they all did. Mel took Paul's hand, and they headed towards his Jeep. This was their last Halloween, and they didn't mind that one bit.
Hooray. That's pretty cool. Maybe a part four for that? Or is that it?
I don't know. I have a thought, but we'll see.
I dig it. It's cool. Really cool.
Well, cool.
Yay.
We'll see if there's an addendum to this.
Yeah.
A mid-dendum.
Right. Right.
So, hopefully you all have exciting plans for your Halloween. Paul, you'll be doing the home haunt again.
It's going to be not as big as usual. We had to kind of dumb it down.
Okay.
Because we've been having issues with the electricity.
Oh, gosh, that's right.
So
that's right.
Every time I have everything that's hooked up to it is all in the same
circuit.
Yeah. Okay. So, long story short, we don't have time to build the facade.
Well, that's understandable.
Yeah, so we're just going to take a year off. We're still going to have something, but it's not going to be...
What if you made a traveling one? Just like four of you walking around holding, like, walls with your face in the walls. Like, bah!
That'd be great. We're still going to have something, but it won't be the same.
Any big Ween plans, Glenn?
I'm going to listen to Ween. No, I'm probably going to go somewhere near Ann Arbor to
is a random place?
To a party.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Oh, are you going to go?
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah.
Watch out for the Halloween house.
I'm going to.
Dun, dun, dun.
What are you going to do?
Hand up candy.
Yeah, I am too.
Mostly to myself. Trigger, okay. Num.
One for you, one for me.
One for them, all for me. But that's about it. And playing with our werewolf.
Yeah. I'm going to try to watch as much horror movies as I can in the next few days.
I have tried, and I just haven't, like, I still have to get your Masters of Horror. I watched God Help Me Dance of the Dead yesterday, and I immediately regretted it.
Not the best one.
I immediately regretted Toby Hooper's whole career for a minute. I was embarrassed for
you hated it so much you didn't like Texas Chainsaw anymore.
I feel bad for Robert England should never have ever worked with Toby Hooper.
Yeah. Like, the Mangler was maybe worse than that.
What's that stupid Gator movie he was in? Terrible. Like, and it's funny that Toby Hooper always casts him as a sleaze, like a super creepy sleaze. And I don't know if that's just,
maybe it's because, like, sort of the biggest part.
The gentleman's agreement between them? Like, I'll always be the sleaze.
I must be the sleaze.
Yes, you shall. My good sir.
It's my favorite, Dr. Zeus.
Yeah.
Sleaze? What a cool character he was.
Sleaze is greasy and grimy galore.
By Dr. Zeus and Toby Hooper.
Sleaze says more, more, more. Toby Hooper just says tits. So I haven't really gotten a chance to watch a whole lot. We've been watching, you know, the TV stuff. Like,
right.
Which is, it is weird that there's so much television horror these days that you kind of just load up on.
Yeah, I try to watch.
Carbo load.
Every Halloween episode that I can.
See, I'm not even thinking. I'm thinking of the horror stuff that's out.
Yeah, there's tons. Yeah. Like, you were talking about The Exorcist. I'm behind on. I haven't watched any of them.
Super, surprisingly good. Like,
I got them all sitting on my DVR just waiting. I may watch them tonight.
Watch me. You should.
Actually, I think I will. You guys got me hyped up by my
goal.
I was surprised. It's pretty brutal, and it's very interesting what they're doing with it. Is
awesome
because they took what the template for The Exorcist, and they're kind of like used that to kind of build off of, like, okay, cool, like that's what they did, and so there's echoes of like thematics and stuff and kind of
that's shadows. Good. That's what they should.
But yeah, like so it's interesting.
Good. I've been loving Ash vs. Evil Dead.
I don't know when I'll ever catch the new season, but yeah.
It's just pedal to the metal this season, too. I'm just...
Are they actually expanding the... Because my problem... The only problem I've had with all of it is that they don't really get into much about the Deadites.
Like, oh, it's coming.
Okay.
Yeah, it's coming.
Because it's just kind of like, they're just Deadites. And like, I feel like... Something's leading them. There's something going on. They just don't get into it.
I feel like that part is coming, but these first few episodes are just... Man, we never need a sequel. We don't need a sequel anymore. They're so good.
Really?
Yeah, wow. They're just so good. I've just been laughing and feeling giddy. I'm like, I can't wait for the next one. I watched the one right after the fateful Walking Dead episode, which I won't say anything about, just in case.
Right.
But I watched it right out of that, and I'm like, oh, thank God for this show. Man.
See, I saw, I'm zooming around on Amazon, and I saw... Like, they're selling the scripts that Joel Hill had written for Tales from the Dark Side. And I remembered, I'm like, oh, shit, I forgot that they're actually going to do that show. And what a shame they didn't do it like they've done, oh, my gosh, what the fuck is it? Channel Zero.
Oh, I'm loving Channel Zero.
And it's a brilliant way to do it. It's
so
like,
good.
Thanks to Europe and Britain with the whole short series stuff. Like, we were like, oh, hey, you can have a six-episode show. And like,
just have it be great.
Yeah, leave it at that. And, like... It's a great idea, and like with Channel Zero, it's great that they're giving you like I think 6 episodes, and then next season, because they already agreed, give a thumbs up for next season. Next season is another creepypasta, and they're just kind of expanding them.
Yeah,
because this one's Camel Cove, and it's so creepy. Yeah, it's got a super.
Have you watched them at all?
No, but even Netflix goes with that.
Absolutely.
Little 8. Or 10 episode shows.
Yep.
And it fits great.
Smart.
Because it gives you enough time to really get invested and then for a breather.
Wrap up the story a little bit. Yeah.
Because
the next season of Scream is 6 episodes, too.
Yeah, because they're kind of. Which I'm glad that they're. Because, oh, shit, they're doing a special.
Like, watched it the other night.
It's already out.
Yeah, yeah.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I actually like Scream, but it is one of those things like where I think that's good. I think it should end. Like, well, ramp it up and end it.
Without giving anything away at all. They're pivoting a little to keep it interesting.
Okay.
So, yeah, I won't say anything at all, but yeah.
Okay, maybe me and Mandy can watch that tonight.
Pretty interesting.
Okay. But yeah, like, so I like that. But again, like, it's just, it's one of those where it's charming, but you can only go so far with that
right.
kind of thing. Like,
luckily, they made some of the characters pretty likable, I think.
Yeah, oh,
you
yeah.
kind of care about what happens to them. Yep, that was smart. Yeah.
Yeah, and like, that's one of those shows, potentially, when you watch stuff like that, like movies, where it's like, you're better than you have a right to be. Like,
right, exactly, exactly. I thought it was going to be horrible.
Yeah, Scream TV show on MTV, you yeah, that should be suck. Unwatchable.
Right.
No, it's actually, it's gory as hell, and it's interesting. And,
funny, clever.
And I think it captures the spirit of what Wes was doing. Wes's were a little more harder-edged, but, I mean...
Yeah, they get...
But again, yeah.
They get pretty out there.
Nev Campbell's just, like... better actor.
I like
that's it right yeah. there.
I like the way he described it as though, you know, it has everything you need to make a huge failure.
Yeah, that's exactly it, though. Yeah.
You have every element to be a big pile of crap.
Yep. I only watched the first episode because executive producer Wes Craven, and he was talking about it. I'm like, I'm going to watch this for Uncle Wes. And I'm like, this is actually watchable. This isn't too bad at all.
Well, he's interesting, like him and Carpenter are interesting, because Craven seemed like he was just kind of shrugged it and was like, man, fuck it. If they want to readapt stuff, I don't care. Whatever. Yeah. You do you. Carpenter just like, fuck you. I don't care. Give me my money.
Right.
He's more bitter about it. Just like,
right.
And when he looks at right. the Beats on movies and shit, he's like, yeah, yep, beat the thing. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Pay me more.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So, but yeah, and it's funny. I just, non-horror, I rewatched, Crime Wave the other day. That I love that movie so much. It's the you know, sort of lost Sam Raimi that I don't know how they got him to put it out on Blu-ray.
Right.
Because he wouldn't, like, they put it out on VHS, but he wouldn't do shit with it afterwards. Mm-hmm. Like, it's funny because all the interviews and stuff are with Ted and Bruce, which again, like, I would think it wouldn't be easy to get Bruce.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he's on the commentary, him and Ted, and, like, he's interviewing stuff, and it's such a fun movie. It's Sam Raimi directing a Coen Brothers movie,
yeah.
which is
yeah.
fascinating.
Yeah.
But you already see, like, Evil Dead, you can see, has some chops. He already he shows what a good director he is in that. And it's a shame that Hollywood has taken that away from him.
And the editing, too. The
yeah.
editing.
My yeah. God. But, like, with auteurs like that, like, unless you're a Scorsese and, like, super, like, powerful.
Right.
Like, you just don't really
have... You gotta play the game a little bit.
Yeah, and it sucks because, Raimi, this, you don't...
It's too bad.
Like Raimi movies anymore.
He should get that artistic license that like Tarantino gets or someone like that. He's that
well, at least like
good.
Burton gets.
Yeah,
Burton,
at least.
And I can tolerate every Burton movie, but he's just not doing great stuff. I mean, Raimi, you know,
right?
Doesn't you know?
He's clearly hitting his own points though, which is cool.
Right.
But I agree though. Tim Burton, you know. He's hit and miss now.
It makes you wonder, because Sam hasn't directed anything in a while, like, if it's just he's burned out on Hollywood. Because it is depressing when you read, like, how all of these, like, there's interviews with Romero, and how I'm like, oh, yeah, like, I remember, too, like, when he did Land of the Dead, and they're like, oh, yeah, like, more dead, and then they're just like, nah, we're good. They just, because Red and Evil movies came out, and all this other zombie stuff,
yeah.
and they're like, yeah, you're good, but we want, like, fast zombies.
We want we want that. The new thing. Yeah. Raimi did the first episode of Ash vs. Evil Dead, which was really amazing.
Yeah.
And set the tone almost too high. Because I thought the next couple episodes, I was like, oh, this ain't quite where Sam had it. You know what I mean? it was good, though. It was all good first season, but this one, just wow.
Yeah.
I'm amazed.
Because outside of that, I don't think he's directed anything since the Oz movie.
Yeah, because Drag Me to Hell was before that.
Yeah.
I heard he was going to try to make Drag Me to Hell 2, but I don't know if that's going to happen or not.
I forgot. It seems like he was working on something, but it wasn't, I don't think it was anything.
Not a genre thing.
I don't think it was that exciting. I mean, he's somebody that I don't know if I, just like, and that's shame, I don't know if I could have bought, and I know he tried other, like Craven tried straight movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a knock on his filmmaking, but like some directors are just, his stories were more impactful when they were a genre of some sort. Like,
what's that one he did? It was pretty good. I can't
remember. Red Violin?
No.
The plain one.
The Gift? Not
Craven. Oh, Raimi. Oh, yeah, Raimi, yeah. Oh, yeah,
that just worked pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Decent movie.
Yeah.
Not bad at all.
Mm-hmm. And he also directed that one
Oh, God. He did
the Thriller. That was really good.
With the Found Money?
Yes.
Simple Plan.
Simple Plan. Yeah.
That's one of those movies that when you watch, you go, wow, this shows
that. I forgot that was him.
He literally could have won an Oscar type movie.
He could have done anything.
That's him doing another Coen Brothers movie. Yeah. Really, when you look at it, that's like, it just, Coen Brothers always have some kind of humor.
Yeah.
And that's like this humorless.
Yeah, it's a very humorless movie.
So, but you could watch that and No Country for Old Men, like back to back, and just hate humanity. Hate everybody.
Hate humanity, but praise its acting.
Yeah. Yep. Throw in like Eastern Promises or the other like Cronenberg crime movie. And
right.
Like,
Eastern Promises would be perfect.
Punch yourself in the face a couple times. Go to bed.
I'd have to watch an episode of Ash vs. Evil Dead to clear it all from the palate.
Nope, I have to watch the first episode of Walking Dead again.
Yes. Just go to bed completely beat down. Yep. That's great.
Yep, just go right down the hole. Wrap myself in a blanket and roll around on the ground and cry.
Well, he slated to make something called World War III.
Oh.
I think that's something.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So it's going to be about the election.
I'll watch it.
No info on it.
Nothing. So it could not even, might not even be.
It might not even really be anything.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll cast him in my next movie. He seems like he's, you know. Got some free time.
You're gonna cast?
I'm gonna cast him.
Sam Raimi?
Yeah, he's gonna be fake Shemp.
I was gonna say, because he always plays like kind of like cool.
Yes.
And him waving at you.
Yeah.
Get on the road! Hey!
Fake Shemp 3, Sam Raimi.
I forgot to look at the credits and see if there were fake Shemps in Crime Wave.
Oh,
which
yeah.
Which is funny because, again, that has one of the best fucking scenes. Like, the door scene is fucking.
Yeah.
The door's great.
Amazing.
The you know, the
Chase Justice!
The car chase that is not on a set because we drive down that same highway in Detroit.
Yep.
Right.
You're like, how did he get... How was he allowed to do that?
Right.
Because it's Detroit, and they're just like, meh. They're like, should we close it? Meh. Fine. They swerve around people. Nobody will care.
Hmm.
Well, all right, boys. So next couple days will be Halloween, so everybody have a
happy Halloween.
Oh, that was. Don't know what sound that was. I guess werewolf. But yeah, so jack your lanterns and pumpkins.
I was gonna try a Vincent Price voice, but then I'm like, nah, that won't do it.
I don't really know how to do these voices.
It's all Dracula.
It's
all Vincent.
That was actually Frankenstein. I didn't mean to lie. I am the monster.
Fire bad.
Fire so bad.
Smoke good.
Smoke good and bad. Now I wear the patch. I'm going to do smoke.
That's the best mummy imitation ever. He hates fire.
He does
too.
Not like it.
Why am I so invisible?
Does the mummy like friends?
Get out of my lagoon!
Allow me to introduce myself.
Bow of a wolf and a man.
I like how it's not even quite Lugosi. It's just something far a little left of it.
Watch out for the wolfing man!
The wolfing man.
Look out, I'm a human centipede! I'm crawling up your body!
No! No.
Which is great because it's like it's become a vampire impersonating movies. Like, I'm the Jason Voorhees.
He's an Italian vampire.
Oh, what's up with me? I'm in the red group.
He's just Father Sarducci now. He's gone completely.
Father Sarducci is the human centipede.
I'm going to give you the bad dreams with my centipede.
Oh, yes.
Happy Halloween here.
He's Travolta.
For real.
Yes.
I'll stop because I'll just, like, go off on it. Happy Halloween.
Now everyone has to listen to the end of the podcast.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Fuck you, happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Oh, that son of a bitch.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
So everybody out there have a real good
Halloween or WKDV where it's been in the hits. All right.
Turtle Wax.
Good times.
We're going to play a song from the October Dudes. It's called Betty Is My Bumber. Here we go. Worm Mutinous, Chapter 1. The air was acrid with the duality of heat and death. The smell of rotting flesh was everywhere. Its pungent stench attracted the most vile things from beneath the ground in hopes to feast and suck the stinking disgust from the dead. The jungle was rampant with things never seen on planet Earth. It was a green inferno, but the skies were tinged with some kind of red that would bust through the blue and the black with ease and opportunity. It plagued the solar winds with the sway of illness, and it was dying. The winds of a strange hell blasted a rancid stench across the dying jungle. Tortured screams pierced the morning skies with an ear-shattering terror that no one could hear without knowing what horror came lurking. In a village lost from time and space, a failing tribe gathered to make one final offering to this thing that came calling for their finest warrior. No fierce warrior stood this day, however. Only three men that could barely hold their ground would offer themselves. The tribe could only pray that their additional sacrifices would hold the thing at bay. Weakened, diseased hands shook at the sky as tears rolled down their dirty cannibal cheeks. Most of the older women were placed at the center of the clearing, stone daggers in hand, either waiting for babies to be born for ritual sacrifice, or to tear into the stomachs of the pregnant women hoping to give birth before the thing came for them. Other members of the dying clan were fucking each other hard, somehow hoping to appease the massive creature. Wild cries and venomous laughter filled the morbid scene. On the outskirts of the clearing, malnourished men took massive rocks and slammed them down upon the skulls of the elders, ending generations of life with one or two cracking blows. Dried voices cackled final breaths as stone met with skull and blood splashed about the killers. Shards of bone and sludge of brain splattered against the faces of the angered young members, who then pushed as much of the wet and tasty juices down their throats as they could muster. Slippery fragments of gray matter hobbled along the lips of the killers, and blackened, sickly tongues lathered bits of death between rotted teeth. They blamed the elders for the failing life around them and thought that this might help their dire situation. One of the wild men could not wait for another stone to fall upon the elder's head before he attacked him, biting into his aged, bony cheek and ripping away at the tender skin just below his left eye. Fatty, white tissues revealed themselves under the fountain of blood that began to drain below his orb. The violent tugging with his bizarre mouth caused the old man's eye to set itself free, eager to meet the dirt on this one sacred ground. The killer chewed with glee as the old man shook in pain and agony. The wiggling eyeball jolted about the filthy skin on the face of the dying elder. Strange juices slipped about, and a sickly spray of blood painted the jungle floor. The wild man kept chewing with glee, only to stop for a split second when he heard what he thought was heavy footing beyond the trees close by.
This was an age of death and disease. It was a time of horror. Hope and rebirth seemed a distant memory to these damned creatures. Their deity was only known as the rumbling and panicked sounds that escaped their diseased lips as they cried and chanted. In the past, the tribe hoped to arouse it from another slumber and take possession of the healthiest of hunters. If the thing would take a host, it would secrete its vibrant elixir into the ground. It allowed strange vegetation to grow and would subdue their cravings for flesh. The sting slumbered through the jungle, wavered to the festival of sacrifice. It was all that was left of some wild being engulfed in a living black tar. It was a skeletal thing, still moving about on two dead legs, while the breathing slime moved in and out of its bony form. It festered with growth as the skeleton jarred back and forth inside the vile jelly it secreted. The worm rode up behind it like a makeshift spine, sometimes shifting its own girth and releasing a smell so sick that it made the stink of the dead seem like a sweet fragrance. It was a massive, thick, and bulbous serpent, a mammoth, sickening slug from the middle of some otherworldly hell. It gave the corpse the appearance of life, but the slithery alien was the only foul form that truly lived in the ragged, zombie-like creature. It would rise from the acidic muck when the stars were right. It slithered its way from the decrepit darkness and made its way to the flesh, first stinging the skins of the host, setting them into some astral trance. The top of the thing had a wild, gaping mouth that was riddled with pin-like teeth. Surrounding the mouth below it were rows of strange, malformed red eyes that darted about, eerie and unrested. Once its host was in a trance, the thing would twirl itself up its legs and start to nuzzle the twisted tips towards the opening of the backside. The slime that rolled off the worm would coat the skin and spread the hind area apart. In a mad thrust, the enormous creature would jam itself inside, ripping the anal walls and breaking away the form of the cavity. Bones would break and reform, organs would fail and find new life. It would release its tarry blackness throughout the insides of the flesh, assimilating it into a sickening union of man and beast. The flesh would pump and pop as tendrils squeezed out of the pores of the living. What was once a warrior was now a hybrid of life and death. Both man and creature walked among the village in an unlife, mimicking humanoid form, ever-shifting shape and proportions. It was a giant mutant torn from ass to skull, slithering pieces of brutality and fucking life straight out of form. When it was fully erect, the worm would whip its wild tail out of the bloodied ass end while the monster's head would rise up several feet behind the broken neck of the man it became. It was angry, it was hungry, and it longed for another host. The three sickening specimens of what was left to offer as host were placed about the offering to the mighty thing. They were frail and useless. They bowed their heads low and cried with tears they had left. Howls of a newborn filled the air. Cries to the thing came from the mouths of the old women that stared at the new infant's eyes. The mother of the child screamed as the bone tomahawk came riveting down on her head, cracking it open and splashing red upon the weathered skins of her killers. Her body jolted and yammered before she began to shit on the heated ground. Another old woman grasped the cord with her dirty, bony fingers and bit down upon it with her jagged teeth. Warm and sweet juices filled her rotten mouth before the new skin peeled away and released the child from its newly dead mother. Heavy dragging sounds become louder, closer. The thing was upon them. The unmistakable sounds of its slithering wickedness brought terror to the clan. Their bodies shook, and the greatest fear of all time filled their hearts. It was dying time. The crying and screaming stopped, except for the newborn that the old woman held upside down in one hand. In the other, a crude stone blade ready for sacrifice. Its wailing cursed the skies in its pathetic vibrato, and it excited the beast that stood only half hidden behind dying, broken trees. The moment passed with a sloth-like dreariness that seemed to last into another life. Fear was emptying into every beating heart, and dread became the singular fate. The crying child became still as it died, riddled with some alien disease. That was some kind of mercy by any standard. Then, with a single giant step, the thing moved into sight and released its howling. It was a wet, bubbling growl married to some kind of layered, dissonant groan. It was seeping its tarry blackness into the ground as its family of twisted eyes glared at the lackluster offering of life before it. Even in its primal, otherworldly viciousness, it knew that it might befall a prolonged slumber if it did not dwell within another, stronger force. It cried out in the only language it knew as the failing tribe began to back away. They became even more confused at the thing when it began to shake and spout nightmarish gruel from behind the broken skeleton. Wiggling, sporadic tendrils began to shift about and search for flesh. They became impossibly long tentacles reaching and rooting into the skins of its victims. Screams began again, crying and wailing in the tooth, until lungs were filled with blood and their frail lives gave way. Whipping and thrashing sounds filled the ears of the dying, while each acidic, sticky creepazoid jammed itself into the flesh and bone of everyone in its sickening sight. Popping and crunching, burning and sizzling darted about as the creature stood in its spot, shaking and raging. Dark and deadly blood splattered and spilled as the thing drank from the tribe. It was draining them, each and every one of them, until they were dried, crusty corpses and putrid, stinking remnants of what once was. The thing drank from their skins and souls. It had the sustenance that it needed for now, but it needed more than just to eat. It needed to live. The moments moved to days as the blood and other foods dried into dust. The beast withdrew itself into caves of darkness and shut itself down. The territory became still, and the only light to be seen were the strange and poisonous vermin below the ground. The wind cried and waited to be breathed again. The night before Halloween, October 9. The wind was cold that day. The colors of the season were abound in all of their fiery glory, and it was amazing. School was never my favorite place to spend time, but October 9th will always stick in the torture chamber of my psyche. Even now, I sit with tears hiding in my eyes. The sounds of some weeping, far-off cello plays in the quivering chambers of my heart. Echoes of something once loved, now lost, carry on with me. The feelings of who I was long before still cry out for some kind of life, but the life they have is nothing like what it used to be.
I can feel such a deep loss from my childhood. I remember a time when my guard was down and I sat and just cried on my own. There was a time when I felt that I had nobody to cry to, nor a person to listen to me when I was in need. And now, all these years later, I know that I am never alone. Even if it is some kind of phantasm, I am not alone. Anyway, those days, we had about 15 minutes left of recess. I had spent the whole time outside counting the pumpkins that were ready for picking across the way at the Bosley family pumpkin patch. They were the place to go for pumpkins if you wanted to stay local. But if you didn't mind taking a drive, you could go to Deal's Orchard for a classic autumn experience. I took a deep breath and smiled when the ball hit me in the back. It hit me hard enough to take me down and knock the wind out of me. It was thrown by Jill Patterson, that bitch. Stupid cheerleader in training and full-time pain in the ass. There she stood, smiling proud. She made a direct hit with a basketball to my backside and downed her target. A couple of her friends stood beside her, clad in their new jackets and pancake makeup. They were all too young to be wearing makeup like that. I used to envy them in some small way, all that time ago. I thought that this is what it meant to be more grown up. You know, wearing makeup like that and complaining about things like their parents did. I stood up and yelled at them, "Is that your idea of fun, dumb tramps?" Jill yelled back in the whiniest voice, "Not every day is Halloween, you freak." Now, that might just tell you something more about me. Back in those days, we were called freaks. A little later on, we were called nerds or squids. As the 80s moved on, we were often labeled as death rock, but soon after it would be goth. Now, that has no real connection to who I really am, but that is just what you might call me these days if you saw me. Just think about it. Long, curly, black hair, palish skin, a natural affinity for darker colors, mostly black, still, just like it has always been, and more. Morose might be a good word for me. Still, it is all I've ever known. Everything about me called to the fall, and the fall always answered with rhythm and rhyme. It gave me just what I needed when nobody else was there. I had gotten home and looked all over for my mom. Nowhere to be found. I felt so alone already, considering that my folks were not exactly the best in communication. But when I finally did need my mom, she was nowhere to be found. I called for her as loud as I could. Tears were streaming down my eyes and my nose began to be stuffed. I looked around the house and saw all the Halloween decorations and some of the pumpkins we were going to carve, but there was no festivity in my heart. I had a family, but none of them really got me, and none of them were here anyway. After a few moments of weeping to myself, I heard some shuffling from upstairs. Could not have been my sister Sarah by herself. What was this? Down came Dad. I asked him what was going on. He told me that he was helping Sarah to get to sleep. I told him what had happened, and you know what? Dad told me I should pray for them. What the hell? Pray for them? I would not want to waste a moment of my own spit in their faces. I will not be praying for them. I left the house and walked, and walked some more. I was going on a mission, and the mission was accomplished. I made it to the donut shop and took that number to call about that job. When I finally made the call, we talked for a little while before he told me when to come over and start work. I remember a lot of what he told me that day. You know, kid, sometimes the people that are hardest to love or even like, well, they're the ones that need it the most. You know what I mean? It's like they are there making our lives harder because their own life is hard. They want us to feel terrible because they do. That old saying about misery loves company, it's true. Things like that are around for a reason. Some people call them cliche. The people that discount those kinds of things because they are cliche are the ones that want to believe that life is sometimes more than what their own is. They cannot discount some things like that. If you were truly happy, you know, you would not want to bring other people down. And it sucks that people have treated you like this. I listened intently. You know, your dad is right about that, to pray for them. But do you even know what that means? It does not mean to go to church and say a prayer to that dude up on the cross. I think what it means is that if you care about your own happiness, you can wish those kinds of people happiness. If you breathe in and out, you will bring your own body air. If you do the same with words, you can bring the power of those words to you. So if you wish those kind of people well, you might do well for yourself. Just try it. Look up into the night sky, find a great group of stars, or just find the moon. Look up and take a deep breath and tell the universe you wish those people good health, happiness, and that all their wishes could come true. It's really amazing just how much good that can do for you. I know, because I've tried, he told me. I looked at him kind of crooked and thought, what the hell is he talking about? I kind of got it, but it was not until far later that I understood what Damon meant. I finally understood. Maybe I was meant to go through things like most other kids do. It's really weird. No matter what kind of good information is bestowed upon us, we always seem to go our own way until we get older and wiser. I really hated Jill Patterson until I was older. Now I could care less. Now I get it. Hate and anger can kill us inside. When we respond to negative actions with other negative feelings and actions, we hurt ourselves even more. The best thing to do is create a good thing, a love somehow, even if it means to pray for someone to find happiness. It takes the hate right out of you. When I look back then, on that beautiful autumn day, I remember thinking that Halloween was going to be cool after all.